This is the sound of your barbecue before getting a motorized horsepower giddy-up grill cleaner.
Honey, are the burgers ready yet?
Ready? I'm still cleaning the grill off.
Oh, shit. Come on.
Okay, ordering a pizza.
And this...
Burger up!
...is the sound of your barbecue when you purchase the giddy-up grill cleaner. While the grill is cold, just press on and Giddy Up blasts away charred meats, sticky sauces, messy oils, and more. Giddy Up is the last grill cleaner you'll ever need with our dishwasher-safe motorized chain-link roller driven by a powerful high-torque motor, all backed by a lifetime warranty and money-back guarantee. You don't need another cheap grill brush that leaves bristles in your food and makes cooking outdoors a pain. Get your Giddy Up today. Go to buygiddyup.com to get your Giddy Up shipped free. But hurry! Inventory is limited. Order now while it's still in stock. Go to buygiddyup.com and get yours today with free shipping. That's buygiddyup.com.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Let me just start with the official hello. It's a little bit better than that. I'm starting to laugh to myself because I was looking at the chat too early. This is why I have to be careful. I pay attention to the early chat before the live broadcast, and then something will catch me off guard just about when I'm about to go live. So hello, welcome to Scoop, a special Tuesday edition of Scoop. We had a long holiday weekend here in Texas, and we did have some breaking news, which is the passing of the Pope. And actually, I appreciate having Scoop on Tuesday. We also wanted to defer to Jeremy, one of our insiders here on Smarter News, because he was going to be traveling with his wife. So he opted. He gave us the vote. He said, do it on Tuesday. And we said, you know what, Jeremy, you're right. We're going to do this on Tuesday. And it actually gave us a little bit of space to take in the news about the passing of the Pope, which would have really dominated our Scoop broadcast, appropriately so, yesterday. So now we did a little bit of a separate report on the Pope and the passing of the Pope that's available on podcast platforms in case you'd like a little extra and a little clarity on what are the next steps there, but obviously a very big news event. And now we're going to turn the page and look at the rest of the week. We have a lot of interesting news again this week to take in. And so I'm excited to do this with you. But as I was looking at the chat, I was looking at you guys were talking about lunch. You know, Jim says it's 11 o'clock in Denver. Yes, Jim's going to wait a little while for lunch. And then I see Jennifer talk about a late lunch for her. And then Rebecca say it's wine o'clock here. Rebecca, are you drinking wine right now? You don't have to say it. You don't have to admit it to anybody. We're not here to judge you. Smarter News, we're nonpartisan to the core. There's no opinion. There's no political agenda. We want you to be you. Whatever that means. We also want to know exactly what you're drinking, if that's the case. We need facts. We need facts. Actually, I'm going to be talking about this. I like doing experiments on myself related to the news. Let me explain. So sometimes I've done a dry January. I'm not a very big drinker, which is funny. So I do these things, but I don't consume a lot of alcohol. So it's I don't know if it's lost on me, but I'm always kind of curious. You know, I'm always curious about different things. And this is why my beauty cabinet has way too many products in it, because I'm experimenting, I'm researching, I'm double sourcing. I want to know what works. So I did not do a dry January this year, but I just decided I'm going to do 100 days of not drinking and I'm going to see what happens. And I think my 100 days is over midweek at some point. So I'll have a report for you on that. I'm thinking of another experiment I could do for the next 100 days. I was thinking about keeping my phone out of my room at night. Maybe. I don't know. That sounds a little wild. I think that sounds harder than not drinking. So interesting. There's all sorts of interesting research coming out about alcohol, though. And you know, over the course of the 20 years I've spent in news, I've covered all the different studies, the ones that tell you that red wine is good for you, the ones that tell you that red wine is not good for you, the ones that tell you that you should drink tequila, you know, all the different things. So anyway, we're not here to judge. I want you guys to have lunch. And if you'd like a liquid lunch, that's okay with me. We're not here to judge you. We're here to deliver the news. I do have a bit of personal news that just happened as I walked in the door here in Texas. And then we're really going to get to the news. What kind of weird bugs do you have where you live? This is the honest conversation we need to have as a broadcaster to a community. What are the most scary bugs you have? Insects, little creepy crawlies where you live. I have never lived with scorpions until I lived in Texas. And now it's reality. and I had to step over a dead scorpion. It was like this big. For those of you listening on podcast, I mean, we're probably like the length of a dime, a penny. It was very, a very small one. They can be huge. Not a good sign. Okay. The exterminator actually is scheduled for Thursday. I'm like, let's spray it all. Let's just, we cannot have that sort of interruption. There's so much going on in the news. I cannot have that sort of interruption. But for you, what is the scariest creature? I really, even though scorpions I do not like, they scare me. I do not want to be stung by a scorpion. I don't want any of that experience. I still think cockroaches are at the top of the list. And that comes from trauma of living in New York City, specifically above a restaurant in a 5-story walk up at one point, where even 5 stories up, you could hear the cockroaches walking on the floor. That's how big they were. Okay. Mommy B says brown recluse spiders. Absolutely. Those are scary. I don't love it. I don't love it at all. Michaela, ticks in Nebraska. Ticks are very tricky. We don't like the ticks. We don't like the diseases. We don't like anything. Ashley says a capital no to scorpion life. Ashley, in solidarity with you. Thank you very much. Emily Lee, stink bugs aren't scary, but they are everywhere in Tennessee. We do have wheel bugs, which are freaky and bite. I don't know if I want to know about that. Tracy says, I grew up in Florida. So many options. So maybe we've actually realized a point of togetherness that we can spread across America, which is, we love that. It's an Earth Day today, guys. Isn't it Earth Day today? It's Earth Day today. We love our planet. We want everyone to be healthy and happy on the planet. I just don't want to live with directly in the same proximity as some of these little creepy crawlies. I can respect them from afar. From afar. So, all right, should we get to the news? I got a lot of really interesting news for you today. I'm excited. I do want to start with sort of a serious topic, though. And I'm curious what you think about this. And I just want to put this on your radar. This is one of the things that we get to do a scoop that in a normal news broadcast, you're just lurching from one 24-hour news period to the next. And I was thinking about this weekend, and I really wanted to create a little space for this. There are two terrorist attacks, have been described as terrorist attacks, and I'll preface that in a moment, in our country during the month of April. And both of them, depending on where you live, can really easily be overlooked. If you live in Oklahoma, I'm certain that your local news will likely cover the Oklahoma City bombing that took place April 19th, 1995. It killed 168 people, 19 children, wounded hundreds of others. It was the worst terrorist attack to date. That's how it is described in the country up until that point in 1995. We now know, obviously, we've had terrible terrorist attacks, including September 11th. But at the time, this was the worst of the worst. And it was described and continues to be described as domestic terrorism. Domestic terrorism is an interesting title. It's something that we hear from the government, concerns about domestic threats or domestic terrorism. You cannot be charged with domestic terrorism. It's an add-on to additional charges. So let's say you're charged with murder, for example, but there's not a freestanding charge of domestic terrorism in the United States. It's a little tricky legally, which is why sometimes that language, we want to make sure we source it to who's describing an event that way or how it's being used directly in court, because sometimes it can be used politically. But the Oklahoma City bombing, we marked the passing of 30 years since that event just this past week. And I didn't see a whole lot on the news on that. And it's actually something we reached out to try to do some interviews on, thankful to some members of our Scoop community that gave us a few names. I'm still pursuing those because it's an event that for some is sort of falls off the periphery of what we kind of are thinking of when we're thinking about terrorism in the United States. Now, I just talked to a friend this morning, one of my colleagues at Smarter News, and asked her about this. And she said, well, my husband and I just watched 3 different documentaries on the Oklahoma City bombing. So perhaps that's been your experience too, that you're seeing some of these special items or special presentations about this event that are outside of the news. I'm really focused on the news, as many of you know. That's my love and my passion. And sometimes at the end of the day, I don't get to documentary. But if you have suggestions on that, I'd love to include those in the show notes. Another big terrorist event, again, a significant one in the United States, took place on April 15th, 2013. And that is the Boston Marathon bombing. That was a terrorist attack that took place at the end, well, actually mid-marathon. It was right at the height of when sort of your core group of runners come across. And when I talk about core group of runners, sort of your more pedestrian hobbyists that are running this race. That attack killed three people in the moment, injured 500 plus others. The two terrorists that fled, one of them killed an MIT police officer. So in total, if you look at this event, you're looking at four people that died. But of those injured, one of the numbers I saw was 17 experienced loss of limbs because of these explosions that took place. And as you know, one of our Smarter News member, a Smarter News member of our community, was there at the time and was also injured. And Michelle is her name. And we've done a couple interviews with Michelle over the years because she's provided some insight to us. I just don't want to miss these events because we had Americans that were hurt and there were ideologies that were driving both of these incidents that continue to be in our news today. Whether we're talking about domestic terrorism and in the case of the perpetrator of the Oklahoma City attack, he was angered by what he thought was federal overreach into particular events that predated his attack. So his expression of this crime was against the federal government. And that's something we've talked about in recent years, haven't we? We've talked about how there are a variety of different bulletins that have gone out from the Department of Homeland Security and others about concerns about threats that are domestic threats in the United States to the stability of the government. There's been a lot of political conversation about that, political debate. I'll let that political debate continue to happen, but it's something that's been brought up in the narrative of our times. This has been part of our storylines. And this also has, when we see in the Boston Marathon bombing, when we look at Islamic terrorism, terrorism that's motivated by a specific type of ideology tied to Islam, this is something that we continue to talk about to this day when it comes to national security. There's one of the convicted terrorists that remains alive. One died during this massive manhunt. One was killed. But one of them survives and remains on death row, federal death row, having received the death penalty for his actions on that day. And of the many commutations that President Biden distributed in his final hours in office, this individual did not get one. And so this is a case we're going to continue to watch may come up for us in the next several years, depending on if and when this federal sentence is carried out. And that is something that the president, President Trump, has talked about recently in his first 100 days of office, about the importance of the death penalty. And the Justice Department has talked about that as well, as they're seeking the death penalty against the alleged perpetrator of the murder of a UnitedHealthcare CEO in New York. Again, we don't say these names because we want to make sure that we focus on the victims. And these are, again, just these news items that are coming up. I just want to make sure that we remember the people impacted by this and these massive events that in those moments brought the country together against evil. And we don't ever desire those moments. We don't want to desire a moment that brings unity through evil. But these were really important events in our history that changed the course of American history. And so as I was looking at the week's news and going into Easter and kind of all of this different sort of chaos around us, I just didn't want to forget that. So I wanted to make sure to mention those two different topics to you, and we'll continue to watch those stories as they develop. But if you have suggestions, if you've seen different pieces, documentaries, or read something that you thought was interesting, please share it, because I think the more that we can share and just remember those impacted, the more prepared we are to look towards the future, where, again, the core of these stories, if you look at those themes, continue to be part of our news cycle. So just wanted to mention that. We're going to continue to have a little bit of a break from politics. I say little because I don't want to overstate it. Politics is in so much of what we're talking about when it comes to the news. And there's going to be a lot of focus on the White House because Congress is out still as part of this extended break where the representatives are working in their district. I don't want to say they're on vacation. When I say, you know, they're out of Washington, D.C., it sort of sounds like, you know, they're on vacation. No, they're working in their districts. Maybe they are on vacation. Again, I don't know their personal schedules, but they're in their district time where they're going to be back at home. They're going to be talking to their constituents, and then they're going to return to D.C. where they do have some big topics to tackle, including a massive spending plan that's in a proposal stage, which we talked a little bit about last week. So we're going to watch for that. One of the big stories that we're keeping an eye on, I wanted to give you a little insight into, and that's part of what we want to do on Scoop, is I want to talk to you about this story that keeps on coming up in the news. And this is, I'm showing you a Washington Post article here. I'm going to make it a little bit bigger. Some of my formatting is not exactly how I'd like to see it. I want you to be able to see this article. It's from the Washington Post. And what its headline reads is, fired Pentagon officials lash out at Hegseth team. So there's been a story that's come up in the press over the last several days. It seems to be gaining some momentum, but I say this with a caveat. You have to be really careful with stories like this that are attributed to people familiar with the situation, an unnamed official. And we really have to contrast what we're hearing from unnamed officials and reports and press reporting and what the White House is saying on the record. All of this is about the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. There is a flurry of activity and reporting that is suggesting that he shared on Signal yet again. Again, that's the private messaging app. Some details that are related to some of these attacks that are happening overseas with some of his friends and family members or some of his colleagues. Not the colleagues that are in the intel circle, but let's say a lawyer, his wife, you know, that he's sharing details that shouldn't be shared in this sort of capacity that he's been criticized before. He's defended himself here, again, saying that these are baseless attacks, but we are also seeing that the Pentagon has let go of some of his core advisor team that used to be some of his, I don't want to say loyalists, but these were some of his friends. These are some of his close contacts. And they've been more aggressive in speaking out and saying that they don't even know why that they were let go. And what seems to be coming back from the Pentagon is that they were leaking things to the press. There seems to be a disagreement about what happened here. We don't really know what happened, but we do know that some of these folks were let go by the Pentagon and are no longer part of Pete Hegseth's team. So the question here when you see these stories is, how much is media generated as headlines during a time when Congress is not here, not in Washington, D.C., and there's still this kind of question swirling about Secretary Hegseth's ability to lead, his experience, and how he's choosing to organize his leadership team. These questions have started before he actually officially became Secretary of Defense. They're continuing. And so are these reports sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, meaning that the media is seeing that there's an interest in this and there's blood in the water, pardon the expression. And so there's more and more on this topic, even if there's not necessarily a bunch of new information. At the same time, you have to be very careful about how anyone in government uses the press. So if the White House says on the record, we think Pete Hegseth is doing a good job, we have full confidence in him, and I'm summarizing what the president has said in the past and just recently over the last day or so about this, could someone in the background be painting a different picture? Because that is what the White House is feeling, that there is some insecurity here about Pete Hegseth's ability to lead. And could we see in the next several days that although the president came out with full confidence in Pete Hegseth, that we get an announcement from the Secretary of Defense that he doesn't want to become a distraction to the good work of the Trump administration, and therefore he has chosen to resign? It's very difficult to know what's what. And what's actually just a media story that is getting churned up in the water, and what is real? You know, what are some real concerns from the White House? And so I'm reporting this story as such. I think we have to be skeptical. There has to be healthy skepticism. I think we have to note that these reports are happening, but also give equal weight to the White House and what they're saying on the record with that question of, how is the press being used here? Is the press being used as part of something bigger where there's actual disillusionment with Secretary Hegseth, or is there a no there there and the press is going after something just because it's juicy because there's a disagreement in the office and it's nothing more than that? So something to watch, something to keep an eye on. Just wanted to flag it for you. In addition to that, I just want to show you one more thing. We got some new border numbers, and I like to make sure that we're showing this to you. Every month, we get these report cards on what's going on with the U.S. border. We know the border really matters. It becomes a political hot potato issue when we get towards election times, but it can become a hot potato no matter what news cycle we're in. And what I want to show you here is, if you look at the red line, I'm going to go in and point to it with my cursor here. The red line is showing us what this border looks like. So here's October, November, December. Remember, Biden, the Biden administration is still in office. President Trump comes into office January, February, March, and we're seeing a massive decline here. The border numbers of encounters, those that are encountered coming across the border without legal status, were already in decline during the Biden administration. That is true. But the massive decline that we're seeing over the last several months is notable. And here's a story that I actually think is one of the most important. So here's, let me make sure I get this updated for you. So here's the red line. We had the total encounters in the month of March, just under 30,000. Last year, for perspective, they were over 240,000. So a huge drop, a huge decline. But here's what I think is actually the bigger story. I want to look at unaccompanied children coming across the border. In March, there were 702. In February, they were 836. If we compare it to the same time last year, there were 8,880 unaccompanied children that were encountered at the U.S. border in March. Again, this past March, 702. There's a massive drop there. I think that's a big story. It's one I'd like to ask the Department of Homeland Security about. What is that about? Because when we talk about unaccompanied children specifically, we're zeroing in on a part of what's happening at the border, which is human trafficking. And we also have to be very careful with that term unaccompanied child or unaccompanied minor, because typically when we're talking about a minor, we may think in our mind a four-year-old little girl, when in reality, an unaccompanied minor is usually a male between the ages of 14 and 17. So there's a story there. I don't know what it is. I just want to make you aware of it. I think the declines are part of the story that the president is trying to tell about national security. This is a policy promise of the Trump administration. And we can have a robust conversation about why this is taking place. You know, what are the specific policies? How is Border Patrol empowered? When we get another month under our belt, I'd like to see 90 days really under the Trump administration. We're sort of there with half, a little bit of January, but we have February and March. Let's see one more month and let's dig in a little bit more about why exactly this is happening and how did it happen so quickly? What is actually the key policies? So just want to make sure that you're aware of that as well. Okay, here's a story that I really want to dig into today. And thank you. I see a question from Jessica here. Is that tool showing all the border, just the southern? So the tool that I was showing to you is available. I'll put it in the show notes for you. And I want to pull it back up again. It is showing us this is all, so this is nationwide. So I can show you nationwide numbers. If I'd like to just show you the northern border, for example, I can show you the numbers just for the northern border. And that's, by the way, for unaccompanied children. So let's just make it all. So all encounters for the northern border, we can see this drop of decline. I can look at it for the southwest land border, also showing a decline. But you're able to actually play with this, also take a look at different citizenship. So where are people coming from? Right now, I've clicked on all. So we're just taking the massive group, but you can take a closer look. You know, how many people are coming from Ukraine? How many people are encountered coming from Cuba or Russia or China? And so you can actually play with this. It's a very unique tool that has been available throughout any administration that I've covered. So it's not unique to the Trump administration. That's important. I see someone here, Carrie, with a comment. Carrie, as someone who grew up on the Texas border and whose husband works for Customs and Border Protection for 30 years and has a son now doing the same in a busy Texas border city, this is a big deal. Carrie, let me know if your husband or son want to talk off the record. Always we'll have a conversation on background. We love their perspective because they're going to know better than anybody. What does this look like? Why is this happening? And what is the bigger second and third order effects of it when it comes to the United States of America? Why do borders matter? It's how countries define their territory, period. And although there's different ideas about border policy, this is why borders are important. Okay, something's happening at the Supreme Court today, and I'm really excited to share this with you because it's a case that has a lot to dig into. And so we're going to spend a little time here. While we have Congress in their home districts and we have the White House working on a variety of different issues, we're going to continue to pay attention to that. The Supreme Court is hearing a bunch of cases. And what they're going to do with some of these cases that there is quite a bit of publicity about, including the one I'm about to talk to you about, is that we're going to get the decisions in the next couple months. So it's April 22nd. We can see the decision on this particular case by the end of June. So while the Supreme Court is hearing these cases, there's kind of this rolling cadence to hearing cases. We don't get any of the decisions until just about the start of summer. And so there's both a lot of anticipation, and then you don't really get a reward at the end because it's not like you get the decision right away. But it gives you something to think about. It gives you a lot of space. And this particular case is going to do just that, and I'm excited to dig into it with you. So this is a case that takes place in Montgomery, Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland. And I want to show this to you. I always need a visual. I want to show you just, you know, where's Montgomery County, Maryland. So I'm showing you a map here on the screen. It is about a 45-minute drive from the White House in the state of Maryland. And Montgomery County has a reputation for being extremely religiously diverse. In fact, some call it the most religiously diverse place in the country. Which, think about that title. Fascinating. So you have a lot of different people, a lot of different beliefs living in one area together. And that could be a factor in this particular case. In fact, it is, because the case I'm about to talk to you about, some argue, is about religious freedom. And others argue, isn't really about that at all. So let's dig in. So in Montgomery, Maryland, the school district there in 2022 made a decision. They said as part of their curriculum, they would like to weave in books that have LGBTQ characters. These books would be part of their language arts curriculum, and they would be seamlessly part of what the teacher was teaching, which was really about English. But instead of using traditional books that have been used for many, many years, these books were just going to have different characters. And it was a way, some have described, of including different people with different backgrounds and different beliefs, essentially, in the library of different books that are used as part of the curriculum. Again, this happens a couple of years ago. The school district announces it. They move forward with this plan. Very key here. What are the grades we're talking about? Pre-K through fifth grade. So elementary school age children. Again, this is part of language arts curriculum. It's not part of health. It's not part of sex ed. It's just part of English. We're going to use these couple of these different books, five different books that were chosen. Now, the school district, knowing in part, and I'm kind of putting together a couple of pieces here, knowing this was new, gave parents the permission to opt out. So if parents wanted to opt out of a language arts lesson that included a book that had one of these characters in it or had a story that involved something regarding, let's say, a transgender child, or there was one story that was about a puppy who got lost during a pride parade, they would be able to opt out. So they would get advance notice, and a parent could say, okay, well, that's not what I would like my child to be exposed to at this time. And the parents, citing religious freedom in this case, decided to do that. In fact, so many parents decided to opt out, it became a problem for the school. And instead of continuing the opt-out program, the school decided to eliminate it. So parents were no longer able to opt out of certain curriculum that used this book. If your child was in, let's say, second grade class with their teacher, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and it's when English was going to be taught, then if this is the book that the teacher was going to use, then the teacher was going to use it. You're not able to opt out of that particular lesson for a different lesson. Again, the school said it was just too hectic. It was too much. And there was also a few other reasons that were causing discord that wasn't necessarily anticipated. But again, the reason the school shut down the opt out was because so many parents decided to opt for it. And that also led to some absenteeism as well. So the parents are saying, wait a minute, we didn't ask for the school not to include the books. We actually don't have a problem with the books being included as part of the school library or even part of the curriculum. We're not asking for the books to be banned. We're not taking issue with the books at all. It's just that the characters, the topics in these books is not what we want to expose our children to at this time because of our religious beliefs. And now we're being coerced. We're being coerced because there's no option for us to opt out. Now, the lower courts, this went to court. So this in 2023, now we're starting this legal process. So a couple of years ago, the lower courts did not side with the parents. The lower court said, okay, fine, you have an issue with these characters, but they're not coercing you to change your religious beliefs. You just don't want your kids exposed to these ideas as part of public school. And that's not protected under your freedom of religion. Like, you can't limit your exposure to a certain character or a certain topic and cite religious freedom. This is not asking you to believe something different or practice something different. It's just part of what the school has chosen for their curriculum. Again, a lot of really interesting sides to this story. The plaintiffs, the parents in this case, actually represent a diverse religious background. So it's a group of families that took the school to court. They include a family with a Muslim background, Roman Catholic, and Roman Catholic Ukrainian Orthodox background. And again, the lower courts ruled against those parents and said that exposure to these characters did not impede them practicing their own religion or compel them to behave in any way. Therefore, the schools are allowed to do this. The parents are saying, well, if I the only option I have is to pull my kids out of school, but I'm a taxpayer, I'm a citizen of the United States, I want access to the public school. So this doesn't make sense. I do feel coerced. And here it was appealed to the higher courts. A couple points here I just want to clarify, and then we're going to hear a little bit from the Supreme Court today. And then I'm going to show you one of the books because, you know, I ordered one. I wanted to check it out. I have to do all those things that influencers do with their nails. Okay. I'm going to read some of this to you. It's going to be story time. Okay. We're going to get into it. Here's a couple points I want to clarify. Again, the parents did not want the books banned from the school. They don't want them removed. They just want the opportunity to discuss these topics if and when with their kids at a different time. And they felt that tackling them in school infringed on their ability to do that and to practice their religious beliefs that maybe don't include support for these sort of choices. I'm trying to use as neutral language as possible. The school argues this, and I'm going to read here actually from the New York Times. I'm going to read from the brief itself. The storybooks themselves do not instruct about gender or sexuality, the schools argue. They are not textbooks. They merely introduce students to characters who are LGBTQ or have LGBTQ family members and those characters' experiences and points of view. The school's saying, listen, we're not like going in depth about different lifestyles. This is the same as another fairy tale that had two straight people in it. We're just having two characters that are homosexual, and we're not getting into the nitty gritty of what that means. It's just, it's like having two blondes and then you're going to put in two brunettes instead. It's not really about that. It's about the books themselves, the values that have to do with courage and standing up for who you believe in and fighting for what's right. Like, that's what these books are really about. They're not about, we're not digging into relationships and what those are like, or what does it mean to be gay? Like, we're not doing any of that. This is we're just using the story. Now, a parent who actually was arguing in favor of these books and wants them as part of the curriculum that's in this school district wrote an amazing opinion piece in the New York Times where she really takes on all sides. Again, she would like her students to have access to this. And she says this, it's a very straightforward editorial. So she says that the district is arguing that the books told stories that touch on the same themes introduced to children in books like Snow White, Cinderella, and Peter Pan, that the characters just happen to be LGBTQ. And she says this, I don't believe it's true. And I say that as someone who'd like to keep the books around. Some of the books in question are stories specifically about the revelation of gender identity or sexual orientation. It's disingenuous to pretend that a room full of very young readers won't end up grappling with the very topics of sexuality that parents can't opt out of in health class. Okay, so you have some perspective there. Let's talk a little bit about opting out in health class. And because this ties into what I want you to hear from the Supreme Court, when one of the Supreme Court justices is questioning the lawyer representing the school district, there's a little bit of a disagreement about what you're able to opt out of in schools. In Maryland, in a lot of school districts, you're able to opt out of not necessarily health class. Health class is often mandated, but family life planning class, where sometimes you're talking about functions of the body as one is growing older and approaching teenage years, different relationships. You're talking about sex. For some of you that have young ears, I should have offered a little bit of a warning before I started this podcast too, because, you know, it is a topic that not everyone wants their kids exposed to. So parents do have the opportunity to opt out of some of those lessons, but there are those that argue that's not what we're talking about here. And to compare having gay characters with a class that's teaching about specifically about sexuality actually sexualizes people that are gay. When it's really, what's the difference between having two gay characters go upon a certain plot and two straight characters? It's not really, we're not talking about sexuality for either of them. We're not going into depth on either of like, oh, well, the man likes the woman because this is what's happening, or the man likes the man because it's just about the plot of the characters. So this question of opting out and how it's applied is one of the big questions. And going back to that editorial written by the mom that supports access to the books in the curriculum, but sees both sides of the story, you know, she says, really, everyone was doing their best with the opt-out option. It wasn't ideal for the school. The school found it very unwieldy. But with the opt-out option, there wasn't this conflict. Again, because the parents of those opting out didn't want to strip the school of the books, didn't want to make a bigger deal about it, just didn't want their kids to be part of the curriculum. This is at the core of this exchange. Justice Kavanaugh is one of the voices, I believe, and Justice Jackson. We don't get to see the Supreme Court justices. We get to listen to these hearings. And this is something that came out of the pandemic that we didn't always have access to. But since the pandemic, now we're able to listen to these Supreme Court hearings live as they're taking place. And so it can be difficult to grab sound bites because you can't rewind very easily. But I was luckily recording this part, and I want you to hear some of the back and forth. Again, this is with the lawyer that's representing the school district.
Things. The other Maryland counties have opt-outs for all sorts of things. And yet for this one thing, they changed in mid-year and say no more opt-outs. I'm just not understanding feasibility.
So again, I think what's in the record is that with respect to these books, as they were deployed in the classroom, there was high absenteeism in some schools. For example, dozens of students being opted out in, I think Mr. Baxter said, the average size of an elementary school in Montgomery County is 700 students. So each grade is 125. If you have dozens of students walking out, making arrangements for those students to have adequate space and supervision and alternative instruction, I think is infeasible.
But then they do it for all sorts of other opt-outs.
They don't do it for all sorts of other opt-outs. There's a limited universe of things that students can opt out from.
I want to pause here for a second. This is true. So we think about opting out. Probably a lot of us think about that health class because many of us probably went through a certain stage in school. I know I did, where maybe it was fourth grade and we're going to start talking about certain things, and your parents had the option to have you not be part of the class. Like, but in reality, there's not a lot of opt-out for curriculum. And one of the questions with these cases is, if there's an opt-out allowed in this situation, where does it stop when it comes to religious freedom? Let's say you're in science class and someone wants to speak about Darwinism, for example. Or, I mean, we can even extend it to evolution, dinosaurs. When do parents get to say, when do they have a say with the school district and say, that's not exactly what we believe, and that's infringing upon my religious freedom? And when is that the parents may be overstepping for what the schools are there, that's been decided as part of the community, this is a curriculum that we're teaching for X, Y, and Z reason. So think about that as you're listening to this, because this idea of opting out may seem like something that's common, but when it comes to things in other subjects, it's not really that common. It just was a salve in this particular case. Let's go ahead and listen.
Family life and healthy sexuality curriculum stands alone. It is mandated by the state. It is something where you are able to predict precisely when the curriculum is going to be deployed.
It's the most similar substantively to what we have here, and there's an opt-out allowed there. I guess I'm not understanding why Montgomery County School Board stands alone, I think, in the country. You can tell me if there's another school board that's done something like this. The kind of books that are being used and prohibiting opt-outs. And I guess I'm just not understanding the whole goal, I think, of some of our religion precedents is to look for the win-win, to look for the situation where you can respect the religious beliefs and accommodate the religious beliefs while the state or city or whatever it may be can pursue its goals. And here, they're not asking you to change what's taught in the classroom. They're not asking you to change that at all. A lot of the rhetoric suggests that they might have, that they were trying to do that, but that's not what they're trying to do. They're only seeking to be able to walk out so that they don't have to, the parents don't have their children exposed to these things that are contrary to their own beliefs.
I understand, Your Honor, and there may well be circumstances where a school can or a school district can engineer the win-win. Montgomery County Schools tried to accomplish an educational goal of introducing these books for a particular purpose. They then attempted to accommodate religious opt-outs in the school, and they weren't able to.
Mr. Schoenfeld, what is that purpose? I mean, I thought the answer to Justice Kavanaugh's question was that the school board was explicit that the books were to be used only to supplement the English language arts curriculum as reading instruction and not to teach about gender or sexuality. So it wasn't as though the books were being introduced for the purpose of enhancing the gender and sexuality
Absolutely.
Component, and therefore people can opt out of that whole thing. It was that we're talking about English here. And in addition to the other kinds of picture books we have on the shelf and we talk about in class, we're going to introduce these books as well. I think that seems pretty infeasible in English when you're talking about reading instruction, that every time this particular kind of book comes out, we have to start letting people leave the classroom.
I agree with you. And I think it goes beyond the readings of...
Okay, so some of you are asking some very key questions. By the way, again, I believe that was Justice Kavanaugh speaking first and then Justice Jackson. We don't get a little, like something doesn't pop up on the screen and tell you who's speaking. So I'm guessing based on having listened to their voices through a variety of different hearings, even when they were on Capitol Hill. But I could be wrong, but that's who I believe is speaking. And one of you asked, let me see if I can go back to this, which is Natalia, which is what was the purpose of introducing this? What was the purpose of introducing the books? And this was a very interesting debate that happened a little later on between the lawyer that was part of the Montgomery County School District and one of the other justices, which he was trying to figure out, well, what was the purpose of this? Is the purpose just simply because these books exist, they're new, we're going to bring in different characters to our curriculum because we're updating the curriculum? Or is the intention to purposely expose children to this at a certain age for the purpose of inclusivity? There's something behind it more. It's not just about this is going to help us teach English better. There's actually a political, social message there. And if that's the case, then is there something more to this religious freedom argument? Because if you're arguing that, no, these books just help us teach English to a modern community. It's about teaching English. It's not about these characters. It's just about teaching English. That's one argument. But if there's the argument of, and we also believe that this is a issue that should be broached at this time for these reasons, because we're noticing maybe families aren't talking about it in our school district, or we want to make sure that we're proactive when it comes to discrimination, then that may become something different. We'll see. Discrimination is important when we talk about this because, yes, you have freedom of expression. You have free speech. You have freedom of religion. But you know that does not empower you to discriminate. We know the Supreme Court has looked at that over and over again. Just because you say that you don't want to do something, if it's viewed as discriminatory, then you're breaking the law and you don't get the protection of the freedom of expression that's guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. So it's tricky, isn't it? This is a fascinating. I feel like there's so much here for so many people, and it's really a question of our times about how do we view our current curriculum? What do we think about what children are learning? How does that connect with some of the big stories that we're talking about in the news? What do we think about this? So I wanted to buy one of the books. So I did. I bought The Prince and the Knight. And so I wanted to read it. Now, I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. I'm going to give you the context of the book. It's a short read. There is a charming prince. There he is, looking as charming prince does. Got a little crown, messy hair, not totally satisfied with what's going on in his life. A charming prince who is handsome and sincere, lives in that big old castle, which we all want to live in, like deep down, kind of curious about that. What was that life like? And his parents said, you know, you're going to take the throne soon. You're going to need a spouse. And so they go on a little bit of a search for a spouse. And wouldn't you know it, he met a lot of different women, including ones that he made swoon. Here's the thing. He just wasn't that into them. Just didn't feel good. He said, thank you. He told his parents, I appreciate that you tried, but I'm looking for something different and a partner by my side. Look at him. He's sad. Didn't like it. He didn't know what to say. He just knew it wasn't the case. Anyhow, guess what happens next? A dragon. There's always a dragon. The dragon arrives. Fire breather. Looks scary. We don't like the dragon. Villagers are running. The prince is going to be brave. Yep. The prince is going to confront the dragon. Guess who else is going to show up? A knight. It's always a knight in that fancy metal costume, bird face. And what's going to happen is they're actually going to work together. So the knight is going to like shine, reflect off his gear into the dragon's eyes. And then the prince is going to put a rope around the dragon. And by working together, they slay the dragon. So what happens is the prince, though, falls off the dragon. And I'm going to pick up the back part of the story. So the knight races to grab the prince falling, grabs him midair, as you do in a fairy tale. The prince was caught and free from harm, held in the knight's embrace. "You saved my life and you saved mine," they said to one another. And in a flash, to each it felt there simply was no other. The knight took off his helmet to reveal his handsome face. And as they gazed into each other's eyes, their hearts began to race. I do love a good fairy tale, you know, good rhyme. As the villagers returned, it became clear to those around that the prince's one true love had at last been surely found. They're hanging out at the fountain. Here we go. The king and queen had come back too and were overwhelmed with joy. "We have finally found someone who is perfect for our boy." And on the two men's wedding day, the air filled with cheer and laughter, for the prince and a shining knight would live happily ever after. So that's one of the stories. I don't know what age that was in, just to give you an idea. What are these books? Are they about sexuality? Are they about just broader themes about being brave, confronting the dragons in one's life, working together? Or is there something more? And I wish I had all the books, because I think if we had all the books, that could give us a better idea. So apparently some of the school has been a little bit vague about some of them maybe no longer being part of the curriculum. But that gives you an example. I haven't seen this book, by the way. I was able to get it on Amazon, but I hadn't seen it. You know, maybe you have in your own school. And again, this is a question. There's multiple layers, because it's not only a question about parental rights and how do you have parental rights in a school district? What does that look like in public education? What the parents are saying is it's about religious freedom. And that freedom being infringed upon, the school is saying, no, we're not coercing anybody. This is just curriculum. It's just a book. We're not teaching about sexuality. So what are your thoughts on that? I'm going to let you think a little bit about it. Let me see what comments you have. When was the book published? Jacqueline's asking. Let's take a look. When was the book published? Copyright. Actually, the text copyright is 2018. 2018, Library of Congress, by the way, any book that's published in the Library of Congress, which we're going to celebrate today, this week, this birthday. So there's that. Let's see. Jacqueline's also adding, working in education as a speech language pathologist, I would say in the last several years, there's been an increase in diversifying books in a multitude of ways. So that's, and again, is this just sort of what happens? You know, what if the book in a different time, in a different scenario, wasn't about sexuality at all? What if it was about an interracial couple or a Catholic and Jewish couple or a Muslim and a Protestant couple? What if we replace that? Does that change things for you? We wouldn't really think about that, right? I don't know if that would even register with me. So I see one, Krista, the story is clearly more than English. For some, it can absolutely be seen as indoctrination. Charlotte saying, not wanting to have teachers explain this, it's my decision what I want to do that and how. I saw Charlotte was talking about, she was able to view some videos that were going to be taught to her child. And so she had the opportunity to opt out of certain instruction. So this is, again, it's very interesting. Robin just joined. Wow, I dive back in the right time. Maybe it's because I live here in San Francisco, but I have to say I don't feel it's about sexuality. I think we need a larger conversation about how we treat each other. That's a good point, Robin. Is it just about that? Is it just about being able to understand that there's a lot of different people in the community, a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different choices? And if our communities have a reflection of the diversity in America, why shouldn't the curriculum have it? If the focus isn't necessarily on a specific political message, you know, if it's not about something more than just, again, teaching English, I go back to teaching English. So Rebecca has an interesting point. She says, like, Roald Dahl. Do I say that right? Roald Dahl? I mean, I only love all of his books, but his first name is difficult to pronounce. There was some of the books talk about people being overweight or ugly. Those are pretty specific words. When I was going through school, by the way, I grew up in San Francisco, went through the public school setting until I went to a Christian Brothers school in high school, which happened to be in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. It's a school that was about service. So I just mentioned that because it's not like a exclusive private school. No offense to the private school. I'm just putting a little context there. There was a debate at one time, and I don't know if it was specific to California, about Mark Twain and the use of Huckleberry Finn in the classroom because of the language that's used there that was specific to derogatory language for those that were Black. And there was talk about slavery, and there was a question about, well, if we teach that book, are we perpetuating the use of this term that's derogatory? And there were those that are arguing, no, this is historic context. Mark Twain, an abolitionist, this was part of the book, was to show what was happening at that time. That's the whole point. But what do you do with that word? Do you read that word in class? Do you let someone read the word out loud? What do you do with that? I mean, everybody has the reason why I bring that up is not to insert myself into this conversation, but it is true that we have these different moments in school districts about what we find acceptable and what we don't. To Kill a Mockingbird, another example of that, where we might not have that same debate now. Maybe we figure things out, or maybe we haven't. So, Gretchen just talked about this. I just read an article about Huck Finn and how many times the N-word was used. Exactly. I remember this vividly about this debate about it. How do you handle this now in modern times? What does that look like? What about the students that could be uncomfortable about that? We understand historical context. So a lot of really interesting questions. Natalia, thank you. I love this conversation. It's thought-provoking. I think it's really thought-provoking. And it just shows you some of the issues that the Supreme Court is trying to work out. Let me just leave you with this. The Supreme Court does not like to get involved in local issues. I know it may seem like it does, because we'll have cases that come, like the very prominent abortion case that came out of the state of Mississippi. But the Supreme Court does not want to get involved in local issues. They actually want the local legal system or the lower courts to figure it out. They're not looking to come in there. And I know there could be some that argue differently, but in general, the Supreme Court, their whole job is to take a look at the Constitution and protect and uphold the Constitution. So one of the things they have to determine is this actually a constitutional issue that they need to weigh in on? If they determine it's not, then they're going to kick this down to the lower courts again, where we know that the lower courts ruled against the parents. But if they do deem that there is a constitutional question here, what's important about their potential ruling is it could set a precedent for other areas of study. And so that's one of the reasons why we're watching this case. So do they get involved? Do they think there's a constitutional issue here? Do they not? And what are the consequences when they make a decision? So fascinating case. We will put the list of the books that the Montgomery County School District has included in their new curriculum. And you could check them out if you'd like to. And maybe that'll give you some different thoughts on this story, or maybe not. And I'll also include that op-ed, which I thought was just amazing. Let me give a shout out to this mom, because I'd love to have her on the program, especially as we're working through this. Megan Stack, a contributing opinion writer, wrote from her home in Montgomery County, Maryland. This is a must read if you have any strong feelings about this topic, because she goes through each one. And I'm going to not bury the lead here. Her end conclusion is, even with the Supreme Court now being involved, the damage to the community has already been done, because in her mind, there was no issue here when there was an opt-out. It was new. It was different. The parents had an opportunity to move cautiously. And even though she didn't share the caution that those parents had, she said all of the discourse was respectful. And when the parents weren't able to have a little bit of I don't want to say control, because it sounds like the parents were trying to be overly controlling. But when they didn't have an opportunity to weigh in on this particular issue for their child, this is where things went legal. And once things went legal, as many of you know, that becomes, hyperactive. and becomes very difficult to return. Once you start facing off in court, it's hard to shake hands and move forward. So we'll see what happens. I'll keep you posted, and we will let you know what happens when the Supreme Court unveils their decision. That likely will have a decision earlier, but we'll hear about it in June. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about this particular topic, please send in a voice note. We can talk about it next week. We're going to have another very interesting case regarding education next week in the Supreme Court. And I look forward to looking through all of these with you and hope you find them as interesting as I do, because it's not just about this case. There's something bigger, right? It's not just about what's happening in Montgomery County. It's a question too about, well, where are we as a country with this particular issue and how we see freedom of religion, of expression being exercised in a myriad of different ways on a local level. So look forward to your thoughts on this topic and many others. We'll continue to watch some of these developing stories out of DC, and I'll put some more of these links in the show notes for you to peruse. But thank you for your support of quick, concise, nonpartisan information. Oh, and I see Natalia. Don't worry. I'm going to put the link to this. If you just go to supremecourt.gov, if you go to there, it's a very simple website. It's the least impressive website, but it works very well. Okay. So no, I'm sorry. No shame on the web developers for the Supreme Court, but it's very straightforward on purpose. You can actually go to where the hearings are and you just click on it. You can listen to the whole thing. I'm going to go back and listen, because surely there's a lot of really interesting arguments there. All right, guys, have a great day. I'll talk to you soon. And thank you for your support of Smarter News. Bye.
Saving money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kidde products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.